Okay, thank you very much, Eckart. Of course, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present some of our results here. My talk is about the Lagrangian statistics of particles in what I call geophysical turbulence. My home base is the physics department at Eindhoven University of Technology. We are basically working on small-scale processes in turbulence. So, first, a brief overview of what I would like to address today, a motivation why, in the end, we ended up in this particular field, and that is related with some geophysical examples. Then, the first part of my talk is about inertial particles in stratified turbulence. We'll conclude that part summary, and then I will focus on Lagrangian statistics in rotating turbulence. The first part is about mainly numerical studies. The second part is the rotating case is mostly experimental. Basically, what I present here are experimental studies. Main reason for this distinction is that with optical measurement techniques, it is easy to get access to this case. It is more difficult in the stratified case. Although I should say we are now running experiments in, for example, convection and rotating convection with particle tracking techniques. I will end also with a brief summary on the rotating turbulence case. So why did we end up here? First, we call this usually in our lab a tabletop geophysical turbulence. It means that we are not going to do any observations in the ocean. We are all based in the lab, either in carrying out experiments or we are doing numerical simulations. And the focus is on dispersion of matter in geophysical turbulence. And geophysical then means either rotating stratified or rotating stratified. And the stratification may be stable or unstable. I will focus here on stable stratification in my talk today. So these are a few of the topics we are working on in the lab. Dispersion in forced stratified turbulence that are numerical simulations. Rotating turbulence and dispersion in that system, mostly laboratory experiments. We also have been working on convection and rotation. I will not discuss that today. And many experiments and simulations on shallow flows, quasi-two-dimensional turbulence experiments. So first, a brief sketch of the lab people who I'm working with. It's basically the Vortex Dynamics and Turbulence Group at Eindhoven University of Technology. They are all a substantial part of our time working on transport and geophysical turbulence. The group is run by three full professors that are, besides myself, also Gert-Jan van Heist and Federico Toschi. And further, two staff members are involved in many of these efforts, Rudy Kunnen and Bas van de Wiel. Today I will talk about work done by three of my PhD students, Marleen van Aardrijk, Laurens van Bokhoven and Lorenzo del Castello. So what did us bring where we are now? Simply because some 10 years ago we started to explore transport phenomena in large-scale geophysical flows. For example, here's the case, and try to emphasize here what are the effects, for example, of rotation or stratification. Here, an example of a satellite observation of the phytoplankton concentration around the Galapagos Islands in 1998. What you see here is that due to El Nino, the waters are choked off of essential nutrients, but then El Nino stops, and what you see then is upwelling. And then the color indicates the presence of microorganisms in the sea, phytoplankton basically. Phytoplankton, zooplankton. Red means high concentration, greenish means lower concentration, blue is basically without these organisms. And what is the reason of the re-emergence of these microorganisms is related with the fact that the Earth is rotating. So you will have there the effect of Ekman boundary conditions. So you will have the motion of fluid off the coasts, and that, due to mass conservation, results in an upflow of cold nutrient-rich waters, and that basically ignite an explosion of marine life once again.
So
this is rotation.
The upwelling brings nutrients to the organisms.
Yeah, to the freezer, basically to the top layer of the ocean.
Yeah, okay. All
yes. Right. So that was one example. Of course, we are not working on these scales, but at least the motivation. The second one is related here with the coast of South Africa, but also here near Santa Barbara, you have similar phenomena, and in the north of Africa, many places. What you see here is that you have near the coast of South Africa and Namibia, you usually have a wind from the southeast to the northwest. And on the southern hemisphere, it results in relation with the rotation of the Earth to a transport off the coast. And that is due to the Ekman transport in the top layer of the ocean. And also here you immediately see that then mass conservation requires upflow of the cold nutrient-rich water. So then this explains the emergence of quite a lot of marine life here near the coast. And you see a few things. Once again, it is of course the rotation of the Earth that plays an important role here in this process. And the second one is that the ocean is a shallow fluid layer, and that means that the large scales behave basically created two-dimensional. And that relates to one of the research lines we have conducted on shallow flows and two-dimensionality. A third example, more close by, is here the coast of California. Here are two aspects that I would like to mention. I'm not going into the details here of the relation with marine life, but here you have the same upwelling phenomena, but also there are a lot of people living here. You have river outflow, so that all interacts, and are additional sources for nutrients. So that is one of the reasons that near San Francisco Bay, there is a huge high concentration of microorganisms. Santa Barbara cannot be seen here. It is not the usual case, I understand.
It's related to the whale, where the whales travel.
Yeah, I guess so, yes, yes.
That's why they come close to the coast.
Yeah. This is another case, that is the west coast, where you have also a lot of marine life, but that are shallow seas, so there are a few other issues that play a role. Here it is not the upwelling, but here also the aspects of stratification will play a role. That are the transition zones, Atlantic-Sea interfaces, that is influenced by the riverine input, nutrient-rich of course. But there you will have strong vertical turbulent mixing that maybe or may not depends on the situation affected by stratification due to temperature gradients or salinity gradients. It is particle rich, there's high turbidity, so also means a lot of exposure to nutrients, interaction with the bottom. And you have the wind-driven and tide-driven flows. So what are scales here? And that also explains the subdivision I will make today. When you consider these organisms, you are on the subcomgore of scale. Up to 100 microns are the smallest organisms. Kolmogorov scale is roughly, depends on location and where you are, but it's roughly of the order of 1 millimeter to 10 centimeters. Stratification is important at scales from 1 centimeter roughly to up to 10 meters. So that means those coastal areas, estuarine areas, their stratification is can be the main actor. And rotation of the Earth and also stratification, but basically rotation plays an important role at the largest scales. The 100 to 10 to 1,000 kilometers.
Isn't the stratification important over much larger depths than that?
Sorry?
You say the stratification is only important up to the scales of 10 meters. I mean, doesn't it have effect over much longer?
Yeah, but here what I actually would like to state here is that at these scales, basically rotation does not play a role. You have only stratification that may play a role. Of course, at larger, that is the second part. Also, it can play a role at larger length scales. Yes.
Excuse me. So is that? I mean, we didn't even let you get to your second part of the slide, but so in a sense, is it correct to say that 10 meter stratification is the scale where? So you're giving this maximum of 10 meters.
Yes.
That basically this is the strongest vertical overturns that might happen. This is the larger scale which vertical mixing can happen where stratification does not impact it?
Here, where stratification, there in that range up to 10 meters, we believe that basically stratification is the. If it plays a role, it is stratification, not rotation.
Yeah. Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay.
And then for the marine life, of course, turbulent vertical mixing is important, large-scale horizontal advection, and that is what you saw in those satellite pictures. There, it is the large-scale, more or less quasi-two-dimensional. You see large vertical structures, dipolar-like structures, and that is also related with shallowness and the effects of rotation of the Earth. So let's now go to part one, and that is stratified turbulence. A few examples. In the atmosphere, you have aerosol dispersion in the stratified atmospheric boundary layer that are basically heavy droplets or heavy particles in air. And the other case is near the coast, where you have here quite some pollution due to algal blooms that often may occur at certain depths, and these depths are in certain cases related also with the presence of thermal stratification. But that is a different situation, because there you have particles in the turbulent flow that basically have a density close to the fluid density. And when you have sediment, the density is of the order is roughly three times that of the fluid. So that means that these two cases are in some sense different. For the right case, you can simplify many of the equations, and that is basically the standard approach people are using. For the left case, you have to be more careful. So, and the questions we have addressed here is, how is particle dispersion affected by the particle's inertial properties? Preferential concentration, does that persist? I will later on briefly show what preferential concentration is, for those of you who are not so familiar with that. Does it persist for small particle to fluid density ratios? Because the general view is that it is only important for heavy particles. And how is it affected by stratification, if affected at all? So we did that by numerical simulations, and basically we used we need that for two steps. We applied an Eulerian approach for the computation of the velocity field. And basically that is the solution of the Bushnevsky equations. And we used a Lagrangian approach for particle tracking. And what we actually did is the following. We have a cubical box. In three directions we assume periodic boundary conditions. The applied stratification is a constant gradient, so you can use that you can still apply periodic boundary conditions, because it is the gradient itself that is of relevance here. Then we did simulations in low and intermediate resolutions for the stratified turbulence, 128 cube, or at highest 256 cube. There's an important reason here. When a lot of work has been done on Lagrangian statistics in homogeneous isotropic turbulence, there you easily can do simulations with 1,000, 2,000 cube concerning the resolution. And that means that you have a high Taylor-based Reynolds number for these flows, so you can really come deep into the turbulent regime. But you can do that because for Lagrangian statistics, you basically need to simulate one eddy turnover time. That is sufficient for your Lagrangian statistics, maybe a few eddy turnover times. However, when we are considering stratified turbulence, you have to track your particles over hundreds of any turnover times. So that means you need to make a compromise. And the compromise is that we go to lower resolutions, basically a bit lower Reynolds numbers, but do long time computations. It is all forced turbulence, forced stratified turbulence, and all computations have been carried out.
Are these point particles?
These are point particles. I come to that. These are point particles, yes, but we dress them with the hydrodynamic forces. And a point, of course, here it is dilute, so no two-way and four-way coupling is included here, because we are interested in the Lagrangian statistics of single particles or pair particle dispersion-like issues. The stratification, what I already said, we have a linear stratification, d rho dz less than zero, and we all know that when we move up a fluid parcel at a certain height upwards, it will be pushed back in the end, and that gives you also the buoyancy frequency as defined here. So just to show briefly the density field you can expect, the left snapshot, that is a vertical cut of the flow field, shows you the density field on top of the applied stratification. You see a lot of activity here. You are still rather close to homogeneous isotropic turbulence. The effects of stratification are relatively weak. The right plot, you hardly see any fluctuations, but they are there. But what you basically see, it is so suppressed, you will see later on, that you basically see the background stratification.
So in your periodic system, there's a step change in the density from the
yes.
top to the bottom.
Yes. Yes, but we have a constant gradient of the density. And in the end, you only have to take into account the gradient itself. So that is a constant over your domain. So you can apply...
I mean, but it's developing it with the flow. So
we fixed it. It's fixed by basically, once again, it's periodic boundary conditions, and we keep the background stratification fixed. So that constant does not change.
Linear density gradient.
Olivia, yes.
How do you, on something like N.1 where it's getting mixed, do you just impose a top and bottom density and just let it get sort of uniformly mixed between the two?
No, you apply it in advance. You have a background density field.
Evolve.
Yes. Okay. The density field that you apply, I think it's a good point. I did not tell the full story. The density field that I apply is fixed, but on top of that, you force the flow. So there's a background, so you are, by turbulent forcing, mixing the flow. With the condition that the background density remains constant.
But when you talk about background density, you talk about it as an initial condition.
It's yes.
Something that you can specify once you've started mixing it up.
Yes, we keep that one fixed. There's and we are interested in the density fluctuations. Yes. What's it mean? Yeah.
So essentially, if I understand correctly, what you do, you impose a linear density gradient
yes.
as your background flow, and then in your numerical simulation, you only update the perturbations.
Yes, you are computing rho prime, basically.
Yes,
yes.
That's right.
Yes. Are you shearing these runs at all? Is there any shear? Is there any vertical shear?
No.
No, it's just, okay. Just.
So this is what you get for the two of the several cases we have considered, the low stratification case left. These are isovorticity plots, simply to see what you can see in the flow. The left plot basically shows you a kind of spaghetti like in homogeneous isotropic turbulence.
These are pictures of the turbulence, and the turbulence is not affected by the particles, right?
The turbulence is not affected by the particles, but by the background stratification. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
What's the relevant time scale if you wanted to non-dimensionalize?
Sorry?
So, yeah, these are, you've given these in units of inverse seconds, so there'd be a time scale, and this would, of the turbulence or the velocity, so this would be the size of the region and the velocity scale or something?
Well, once again, I missed.
How would you non-dimensionalize this buoyancy frequency? It must be with respect to another timescale.
No, we use, for example, the buoyancy frequency to non-dimensionalize the whole system.
Yeah, but what's the other timescale?
You have the eddy turnover timescale.
Yeah.
And the right one is for relatively high stratification, and such a high stratification that you end up with pancake-like vertical structures in the system. So that means that a lot of the vertical motion is suppressed by the background stratification, and you get self-organization of the vertical structures. And some of you know that when you are that there's a distinct difference between two-dimensional and three-dimensional difference turbulence. In three-dimensional turbulence, you have the direct cascade. So you are forcing the turbulent flow, the energy put in at a certain macro scale cascades to small scales where it will be dissipated. In two-dimensional turbulence, you have, in the ideal case, you have conservation of energy, but also conservation of all moments of vorticity, assuming no viscous effects present. The fact that you also have these conservation laws for the vorticity means that an energy input at a certain scale in two-dimensional turbulence will result in upward transport of energy and the formation of large-scale structures. And entropy is basically dissipated at the smallest scales. And actually, what you see here is that it is not two-dimensional turbulence, but you see some signatures related with the fact that there is an inverse energy cascade in the system.
Excuse me, just to understand the setup, because if this was a stratified turbulent, it was a turbulent event and a stratification, and you would let it go, eventually it would decay. So you're forcing it. So this is it correct to say that you're reaching a steady state,
yes,
somehow, or is this after one buoyancy period?
No, this is basically a statistical steady state.
Okay.
So what we did first here is tracking fluid parcels. So then the equations of motions are quite straightforward, that the position, the time derivative, the position of the particle is the fluid velocity, so that we can compute straightforwardly. So when you do that with isotropic turbulence, you get the familiar picture. Suppose you release a drop of particles somewhere in the center of my box. There's no stratification here. I let it evolve in time. What you quickly see is that it gets dispersed, and at a certain time scale, it will be distributed fully over your domain. So this is, I think, well.
Yes? Your previous slide, did I interpret that correctly, that your particle moves with a fluid velocity?
Yes, because fluid particle tracking.
Oh, okay.
So I come to the inertial tracking later on.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yes, then the next one, when we have strong stratification, we start with the same initial conditions, and what you see.
So this is a blob of particles initially?
Yes, initial a blob with a certain radius.
Put the same material points that we see throughout.
Yes, yes. And what you see here is that basically it is transported only in a thin layer. It is not in a plane, but it is a relatively thin layer, and the fluid particles do not leave that thin layer, at least not at these timescales. There are some subtleties I will not discuss here, but at long times you will get back a kind of vertical diffusion. So let's now look at the dispersion properties in stratified turbulence. And here I have a plot where I show the mean square displacement, non-dimensionalized, for the five cases we have investigated here. First, let's see the black line, that is the isotropic case. There you see, and that is for all the cases, of course, initially you have ballistic transport. The root mean square displacement scales like T squared. At long times, you end up with the diffusive regime. And so it must scale like T. But what you see for the dispersion in the horizontal plane, when you start to apply already a weak stratification, you will see that the long-term dispersion behavior starts to change. Initially, of course, it remains all ballistic. But what you see is that in the end, increasing more and more up to n squared is 0.1, you see a scaling roughly like T squared. And that is not ballistic scaling. I will come to that later on. And then it starts to decrease a bit, but in the end, it all tends to behave like T-squared scaling. Yes?
Would you ever expect a transition then to T-scaling for even longer times in the strongly stratified cases?
I don't think so, because in the end this results in a very rapid filling of your horizontal plane or your thin slab of fluid layer with these particles. So I don't think we can expect that in this set of simulations.
But I mean, the origin of this T-scaling is that you have sort of random independent...
Yes, the diffusive-like mixing. Yeah. But what happens here is that when you apply stratification, you get these... For the high stratification, you can see that clearly in the bottom picture, you will have layers of vortical motion. And that means that in the vertical direction, locally, you will have gradients, vertical gradients in your system. And when you have vertical gradients in your system, that will enhance the dispersion properties. Suppose when you have Brownian motion, go back to that case, in a uniform quiescent fluid, then you will in the end get the T-like scaling for the diffusion. But when you have Brownian motion in a shear flow, you will end up with a T-cube when you have a pure shear flow. And that is related with the fact that you have a shear, these particles make excursions in the vertical direction and will be transported away. And I think this, we believe that this is basically a kind of compromise, because it is not a perfect shear, but it is local, you have a sinusoidal-like shear pattern. And that results in this enhanced horizontal diffusion.
Could it also be because of the inverse cascade? So you have these very large eddies horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you've got large correlations like that, then that would also give rise to a super diffusion.
Yeah, but I believe that maybe, but we have tested this based on the shear argument. We believe that it should be that plays here a major role.
What's the time scale that you're non-dimensionalizing these on?
Sorry, the time scale? That is a Lagrangian correlation time.
Yeah, capital TL is your Lagrangian correlation.
Yes, yes. Okay, and when we consider the vertical dispersion, we see the following. For, of course, the isotropic case, basically the same plot. And when we are increasing the stratification, you see that the vertical dispersion is getting reduced. Okay, and these results were already strong hints in this direction were already available in the literature, and but what we did here is most of these studies were based on decaying stratified turbulence, and it are relatively short time computations. We did long time computations with forced stratified turbulence, and what we see first of all is when we increase substantially the stratification, vertical dispersion is limited. There is a plateau value. There are some oscillations that is related with wave formation. That is one aspect. The second aspect is that in the end you see once again that it starts to increase. And that is related with the fact that fluid elements will also diffuse density in the end. So
behavior now is monotonic with the strength of the stratification. But the previous slide...
Not. You're right, yes. Yes, and that was all about fluid particles. The question here is, when we have inertia particles, how do they still behave like that, or will that be changed? So when you have inertia, then you can start with the expression by Taylor for the mean square displacement, and there are two observations you can make. When you increase inertia, you expect that the RMS of the particle velocity will reduce, and that may result in a decreasing dispersion. This is without taking stratification into account. It's a general expression. On the other hand, increasing inertia may mean enhancement of memory of the particles. So the normalized velocity autocorrelation will go up, will go up. There will be a longer memory. That will increase dispersion. So what will win in the end? That is not clear. But what we expect to see is that there will be some balance of these two effects around, at least for isotropic turbulence, when the Kolmogorov time scale and the particle time scale match in some way, some kind of resonance. So let's, is that, I went a bit too far. So now let's now go to the inertial particles and the equations of motion. What we have here is the Maxey-Rayleigh equation with quite a lot of contributions. Particle acceleration, then we have here the Stokes drag. We have the pressure gradient, added mass effects, gravity, and the history force. And we have the Faxain corrections, for example, these two guys and this one. The Faxain correction, basically, because we are working with point particles, we are basically dressing the particles to take into account the effect of local shear on the particle behavior. Why are we working here with point particles in the case that there is no two-way coupling, for example, simply because that speeds up computations dramatically instead of following the particles themselves. But okay, what is the relative importance of all these contributions? When we have heavy particles, we usually assume that we have the Stokes drag and maybe gravity playing a role. Traditionally, in the last decade, all the other contributions are kicked out of the equation. But, for example, we take here an intermediate stratification. I focus on the stratified case. There is a paper by Amelio Fiorotto on the non-stratified case. And although the results are not fully one-to-one, but basic conclusions are the same, I guess, I assume. What we see here, we have plotted the PDFs of the forces on the particles, all the particles in our system, simply to see how big are these forces on these particles. And does it say if, in the end, it is effective on the particles, because particles, the forces on the particles could balance in the end. But simply to see how what are the values. And what we see is for this is still a relatively high density ratio, Stokes of the order 1. That means that the turbulent timescales and particle timescales are basically the same. And what we see here is that, first of all, that all Faxain corrections are all on this part of the plot. That means that they are not really relevant here. What we expected, of course, but a check is, I think, good to do. And then the added mass, pressure gradient, and the Bessel force. And they are all here on the right side. And these forces are all normalized by the Stokes drag. I should have said that. So it is relative, the value of the force is relative to the Stokes drag. And what we see here is that added mass and pressure gradient should be taken into account. At least you have to be careful what you're doing. This guy, the Bessel force, is usually kicked out, and I think it is usually kicked out because it is a terrible contribution to compute. So you have to devise some smart ways to do this in a competitive way compared to the other contributions. Nowadays, this is possible, and this indicates that maybe in certain cases you have to include the Bessel force. And I will show that for stratified cases, it is really you have to be really very careful, because in stratified flows you will have these oscillatory effects, and oscillatory effect basically means acceleration, deceleration, acceleration, deceleration, and the Bessel force is basically the force that takes acceleration of particles into account.
Can you show us your equations? Can you show me what the Bessel force is again? Just for
this one.
Beautiful term at the end.
Yeah, but the Faxain contribution to that is negligible.
No, that one you can. The Faxain contribution can be ignored. But still, you have to integrate over the full history of the particle, so that is a nightmare.
What about the gravitational force that doesn't show up in the index?
We did not consider that here. Of course, this plays a role when you have density differences.
And once again, the plot was relative to the Stokes drag.
Yes, yes. So, and then what you can do is playing with the density variations. And then you see actually the following. Once again, the Faxian corrections can be ignored. We have plotted here each force contribution normalized by the Stokes drag, the density ratio particle over fluid density from 1 to 100. My previous plot was around here. Of course, here we had the Bessett force that was most dominant. That one, basically, that ratio seems to be basically constant. And that are averaged values, of course, because we had a PDF, so we had to accumulate the data. But what we then see is, of course, that the F5, the pressure gradient, and the, which is it? I have to look carefully, this one, the F4, the added mass, start to become more and more important for the case that the density ratio goes to 1. So that is usually assumed. Yes?
Well, when the density ratio is 1, why isn't it just then a fluid particle?
No, that is the misconception that basically exists. You have a finite sphere that you have modeled. So the usual assumption is, okay, when the density ratio is 1, okay, it are all passive-like particles.
But
that is not the case.
How's the particle radius included?
By the Stokes number. It's a boundary condition. And the Maxi-Weyl equation basically includes your boundaries, the finiteness of your particle.
Yeah, so you're simulating point particles, but in the expression for the forces,
yes,
you take into account their
size. Yes, that is what you are doing. And what you did yesterday, you also in your talk included lift forces and this kind of thing. We also have done that. But
what it doesn't say, though, is it could be that the added mass and the pressure gradient act in opposition to one another.
Yes,
just the magnitude.
Yes, sure. But at least I would like to convince you that you have to be very, very careful and to deal with these forces. So the tracking, let's now first go back to the heavy particle case and see what are the effects on the dispersion of particles in stratified turbulence. The heavy particle case, particle ratio much larger than 1, we reduce here, we keep only one force, the Stokes force. By purpose, we kept out here the gravity, simply because we want to focus on the effects of the forces on dispersion properties. In a follow-up study, we have also included gravity. I will not discuss it here. And then the particle relaxation time defined in the classical way, and the Stokes number is the particle relaxation time over the Kolmogorov time scale.
So gravity is on the fluid, but not on the particles.
Yes, yes. Okay, then, let's once again consider horizontal dispersion. And we did this. This plot is for heavy particles. And we use different Stokes numbers running from 0.3 up to around 7. And in all cases, you see the same behavior. This is the homogeneous isotropic case. The red one is the fluid case. And all the other data are basically on top of that. Also for light particles with density ratios between, say, 1 and 10, you get similar data. So it is not only fluid particles who do that, also these inertial particles do that. And then when you consider the vertical dispersion, the red line is once again, is now near the fluid case with the plateau value. It was for a certain value of the buoyancy frequency, and is 1. And what you see is that with increasing Stokes number, you see that the curve goes up. So it means that heavy particles, in the end, tend to ignore the stratification. So you get, once again, the diffusive limit. And this is, the behavior here is, in the end, not the same as the linear behavior for the fluid parcels. Once again, this is related with diffusion of density of fluid parcels. And that results in the end that particles can make larger and larger excursions from their initial starting position.
So you say here that large particles tend to ignore, they tend to diffuse and they tend to ignore the stratification.
Yes.
But presumably that's true only because you neglect gravity, right? Because
of course. But if you put in gravity, you cannot. It is much more difficult to analyze different contributions of the forces.
Gravity would apply,
yes, of course.
Back to its
yes.
Neutral
yeah, yeah, no. Yeah. Quite surprisingly, these symbols indicate the data with for the light particles. And here, what you assume that light particles that are basically passive-like tracers is not true. They show basically the same behavior as the heavy particles. So they start to ignore the plateau value, and the diffusive regime will be set in. And that is related with the fact that you have finite size particles.
What do you mean by light?
Light, that the density ratio is, I think in this case, is between 1 and 10. I'm not sure precisely what values here
not
are.
Not less than 1.
No, not less than 1, no. And here, a look on the effect of different force contributions. The effect is not dramatic. It is a log scale. But what you see here, in the end, when you are considering the statistical averaging of all the particles, including, of course, the effects of all the forces, then you can observe that basically when I see Q can be ignored. P is without Bessett force. Okay, I have to. And the black line, yes, when you are very close, you have to look. The black line is including all the forces. So what you see here is that in the end, the Bessett force have to be included here. And the reason is that you always have permanently a kind of accelerations, decelerations in the stratified background of the particles. In homogeneous isotropic turbulence, these effects are less important, I believe. I did not check that myself. But there are two. We should distinguish between two points. One is when you have these statistical averages of, for example, dispersion processes. That's one aspect. You maybe are averaging out any kinds of differences. But one also should consider when you have, in marine applications, for example, the formation of flocks or formation of colonies. Then you have locally to deal with the fact that you cannot ignore all these forces because they all seem to be important in the process. Preferential concentration. Show a few results in this on this topic. What is preferential concentration? Basically, then when you have heavy particles in a turbulent flow, what you will observe is that heavy particles are spun out of vortical structures. So vortical structures are depleted of particles, of heavy particles, and they collect in strain-dominated regions. And that means that you will get a non-uniform distribution of the particles when released in a turbulent flow. And the degree of non-uniformity depends on the particle properties and the properties of the turbulent field. Here's an example of a simulation of homogeneous isotropic turbulence. The yellow blobs are basically vortical structures in the flow. Blue areas are more or less strain-dominated regions. And what you see, the black dots, is that basically the particles it can be found in the blue regions and not particularly in the yellow regions. Now for stratification. Once again, release these particles and see what happens. The left plot is the result for the distribution in horizontal planes. Now, what you see here is particles are indeed spun out of the pancake-like structures and collect in the regions in between the vertical structures. And when you consider the verticals cut, then you see that the particles are in some way layered in the system. So there is a clear anisotropy in the distribution of the particles. But nevertheless, what you can observe here is that there is a certain degree of preferential concentration in the system, both here as here. And that can be quantified. And this quantification is always compared with the isotropic turbulent case. First, consider the non-stratified situation. Here we have the upside down triangles are results for isotropic turbulence and heavy particles. That is basically the classical result. In the last 10, 15 years, a lot of experimental numerical studies have been carried out focusing on this preferential concentration issue. What you see here, when you have now the light particles, still heavier than the fluid, but small density ratio, you see a tendency to preferential concentration. Because all the plots, these are all three cases for light particles, but with different values of the diameter of the particles. Here is the Stokes number plotted, and what we see is that they all tend to go down. That means that there is a signature of preferential concentration. It has been measured by computing the average minimum distance between neighboring particles, normalized by the uniform distribution of the particles.
What's an average minimum distance?
Yeah, I don't know the formula, but we can discuss afterwards. I can show the paper where we discussed that. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's a mathematical numerical operation to compute this guy. When we have stratification, and we are considering, I'm not sure I did not put it here, heavy particles. This is the case for the isotropic case. The classical result, what we see is when we are increasing the stratification, we once again can compute the value, the normalized value of the minimum distance. And what we see is, we get the minimum here, it is less deep than in the isotropic case, and the minimum tends to shift to somewhat higher Stokes numbers. But it is there in the system. Good. The first intermediate summary about what are the main conclusions we can draw here. First, stratification enhances horizontal dispersion and reduces vertical dispersion. The second part of this sentence was, there are already quite some indications in the literature. The first one is fully new. Inertia has negligible influence on horizontal dispersion in stratified turbulence. Increasing inertia, long time vertical dispersion increases. The stratification enhances mixing, basically horizontal mixing, because this process can be speed up by the T squared like behavior of horizontal of the horizontal RMS value of position. And in my view, the Bessel force needs to be taken into account, at least for the vertical dispersion processes.
But why do you say light particles there? It seemed to me the Bessel force was relatively constant over a very large range of density differences.
Yes, but for heavy particles, it seems legitimate to, in the end, you don't observe any effect of it on the dispersion properties. So let's now make the next step to rotating flow, and that is mostly on experiments. Our motivation is related with, of course, the first examples I showed today, but also with some astrophysical and geophysical applications, and I'm working at at the technical university, so there are also some industrial applications we have in mind. And many of these issues, it is a combination of rotation and, for example, thermal convection. Here I will focus on isothermal flows. Questions we would like to address here: how does rotation affect velocity and acceleration PDFs? How are Lagrangian autocorrelations influenced by the background rotation? And how do they compare with Eulerian autocorrelations? I will not discuss that in too much detail, the last point, but that were the starting, the basic questions we would like to address. We are working here now not with inertial particles, but with basically passive particles. Of course, in the experiments, we have to add particles to the system, but these particles have such small Stokes numbers, Stokes 10 minus 4, 10 minus 5, that we can consider here safely that they follow the fluid parcels. So, what is here the starting point? Of course, we always make the move to the co-rotating frame of reference. And then the Navier-Stokes equations will see one additional term, that is the Coriolis force. And I should say here that the centrifugal forces are absorbed by the pressure contribution. The flow is divergence free, and we generally introduce here a measure for the importance of rotation with respect to inertial forces, and that is the Rossby number. Basically, inertial forces over the Coriolis force, and ends up with this number. Then there's another number that I will not use further in this talk, except for one slide. That is the Ekman number, and there basically, we are focusing on the fact that we have boundary layers. In an experiment, you always have boundaries. And at the boundaries, you have to deal with the effects of rotation. And that is quantified by the Ekman number. And that is basically the ratio of viscous forces over the Coriolis force. Now, the cartoon of rotating flows and rotating turbulence is this one. Suppose we make life very easy. We assume that we are considering a steady flow. Rossby much smaller than one. That means that the fluid is spinning fast. That viscous effects are negligible. Ekman much smaller than one. That actually means that we are in the bulk of the system and we are not near the plates of the system, the bottom or top wall, and the rotation axis perpendicular to it. At the side walls, you have Stewart's and boundary layers, so that's another issue. When you may do this, you end up with a geostrophic balance. There's a balance between the Coriolis force and the pressure gradient, and that results in the Taylor-Proudman theorem that basically states that any variation in the direction parallel to the rotation axis is absent in such an ideal system. It's a cartoon because almost everything is kicked out of the equation, but it works surprisingly well, at least as a starting point. And the result is that you get a kind of columnar flow structure. I should say here that when you have to apply this also in the context of convection problems, rotating convection problems, you have to keep in mind that you will not end up with the Taylor-Proudman theorem, but you will end up with the thermal wind equations. So the effects of temperature gradients will play a role. For many environmental applications, that is important. Now, what does it actually mean, Taylor-Proudman? There's no vertical variation under geostrophic conditions. So suppose we have a tank, put that on the rotating table. We have an object here in the tank, a disk in this case. And suppose we move the disk in the fluid. We do this from outside so that we do not disturb the flow. What you then may expect is that indeed the disk will move, but a stagnant fluid column on top of the disk will move with the disk. And that is surprisingly different compared to the non-rotating case. Of course, on the top of the obstacle, you have Ekman boundary layers, for example. And there are more complicating effects, but basically what you see is there is a phantom obstacle on top of the cylinder. And when you dye this area, you indeed see that when you are moving the obstacle, the fluid on top of the disk is moving with the obstacle. It seems to be glued to the obstacle. Okay, but then let's go to the first experiment on rotating turbulence. That was done in Grenoble by Hopfinger and colleagues. What did they do? They have the large rotating table facility in Grenoble. And there's a table of, I think, 10 or 30 meters in diameter. So there you can play a lot. Here, they have a setup where they generate the flow near the bottom of the tank by vertically oscillating the grid. And what you see here is that near the oscillating grid, you will generate turbulence that is so vigorous that it is basically homogeneous isotropic. But like in wind tunnel experiments, when you go upwards, there will be a decay of the turbulence. And then the typical turbulent velocities will decrease. And that means that your Rossby number will decrease. And at a certain height, the Rossby number will drop below 1. It is not exactly 1, but let's use 1 as a kind of border. Rossby gets smaller than 1, and that means that it becomes rotation dominated. And what you see, what they saw then, is the formation of vertical columnar-like structures in the flow. Some 50 years later, Godefert and Lollini did numerical simulations in a channel-like geometry, mostly bottom and top, periodic in the horizontal directions, generated turbulence, but let the system rotate. And what they observe is, in the end, that from the random initial conditions, you end up with these vertical structures. And that is fully due to the effect of background rotation. One remark here, I mentioned Ekman, the Ekman boundary layers. In the end, there will be an effect, an asymmetric effect due to Ekman boundary layers on these cyclones and anti-cyclones. So in the end, there will be a kind of symmetry breaking. So you cannot ignore them completely. In our lab, we did experiments in a slightly different way, but it resembles the Hopfinger experiments. On our rotating table facility, we put a box with water, basically electrolyte solution. Below the bottom, we have magnets, and we have electrodes at the side, so that we could generate, by applying Lorentz forces, we could generate a turbulent flow in the bottom region of the container. Here, this is a non-intrusive way of forcing. So we didn't want to get a kind of vertically oscillating grid, because we also want to visualize the flow by either stereo PIV or with particle tracking experiments. We applied a special array of magnets to generate as efficiently as well a turbulent flow. So this is what you get. Without rotation, we added now some flakes to the fluid. And these flakes, they will move with the turbulent fluctuations, at least at time scales sufficiently large. They cannot follow the smallest time scales of turbulence, but it is sufficient for the moment. And what you see here is that you really generate a turbulent flow in your container. But when you apply already quite strong rotation, this is what you see.
What is driving the turbulence? Is it an AC electrical signal through the fluid, or and the magnets are static?
Yeah, they are static. Yes. Okay. So basically, you are generating Lorentz forces in the fluid, and then the inertia in the fluid does its own work. When we then apply already quite strong rotation, 2 radians per second, then we see these curtains. So that basically are the signature of Taylor-Proudman effects. Once again, the rapid fluctuations of the turbulent flow cannot be followed by these flakes, but this is by purpose. We wanted to visualize here in a simple way that indeed you get these Taylor-Proudman-like features. So this is a kind of background you have in the flow, and on top of that you have the turbulent fluctuations we are interested in. The first thing of that we actually did is stereo PIV measurement to characterize the turbulent flow. This is forced rotating turbulence, and it is the first time it has been quantified in this way. What we do here is now at a certain height we have a laser sheet We have two cameras on the top, so that are like your eyes, so you can look from two sides, and that means that in that layer, in the laser sheet, you can track the particles and extract both the horizontal and vertical velocity components. That has been done, and this is basically snapshots for two cases. The non-rotating case, we have here the white arrows that are the horizontal is the horizontal velocity field, and the color indicates the vertical velocity upwards, strongly downwards at different positions in the plane. Typical Reynolds lambda between 150 and 250. When we now have 5 radians per second, that is really a strong rotation, you have to realize that, you see large-scale vertical structures emerging in the system. And on top of that, you have weak vertical velocities. They are not zero, but they are really basically around in this band, while in that case, they cover all the column bars. So there you see the suppression of the vertical velocities. Now we tested the reproducibility and we quantified the turbulence and to extract, I will not discuss the details here, but all the Eulerian characteristics of the turbulent flow, and it has been published 3 years ago. But we use that as a benchmark for our particle tracking experiments, because that is a different kind of experiment where you have to be sure that you are measuring what you think you are measuring. So that was in the next PhD project by Lorenzo Del Castello, basically the same setup, but now with 4 cameras, particles are added to the system, and now we can measure the Lagrangian trajectories of the particles in the rotating turbulent flow, and directly measuring a full volume. Of course, we decided to choose to measure in roughly this region of the flow, but we have to check if we indeed get results, because it's rather complicated that are consistent with the particle, with the PIV experiments. So that is what I said, we are looking in that region of the flow, and we considered a range of Rossby numbers in these particle tracking experiments. Rotation rates 0.2, 0.5, 1, 2, and 5. And here I have to make one remark. When you look quickly at the table, you see that this seems to be a special case. Look at the numbers. And that is something typical for rotating flows. And that also comes up in the results later, so you have to realize that 2 radians per second is maybe a special case. Because what happens? Rotation usually stabilizes cyclonic flow. That that means that there is a vortex in your rotating system that is co-rotating with the background flow. That means there is a strong two-dimensionalization-like effect in the flow. When you have anticyclonic flow, then it can happen that you have an anticyclonic flow, it is counter-rotating with the background rotation, and that then, by accident, locally, the effect of background rotation is cancelled by the anticyclonic motion. And when you have that, your vortex tube gets unstable. And that is what in the end happens here. It is at a certain Rossby number roughly 0.1, and that is consistent with what Hopfinger observed in his experiment. The precise values of Rossby depends on the setup and all these kind of things. But this is what you have to realize, that you are in a special regime in your parameter range. So the check with the PIV measurements, first of all, the horizontal plane, we could show that you have basically homogeneous isotropic rotating turbulence in the horizontal plane, but this is the important one. These are the data we got from the particle tracking experiments, and the red dots are the experimental data at the levels, at the 3 levels we have done with the stereo PIV measurements. So this is all good. Then we did something else, another check. We have Lagrangian data, so the particles and the tracks are randomly distributed in the rotating turbulent flow. When we have the PIV measurements in the previous set of experiments, you have an Eulerian, some kind of Cartesian grid. So there you have the data of your velocity field well defined. What we did first is transfer our Lagrangian data to the Lyrian grid and then apply the whole the classical tools we used before, and then to see if we get the same results. And this is what we indeed see, because here we compare the Eulerian integral length scales, in particular for the horizontal plane. The vertical one is a different issue, but what we see is that for the non-rotating case, the case with 1 radian per second and 5 radians per second, basically these data fall on top of each other. So different informations we extracted from the PTV experiments and the PIV experiments indicate that we are basically investigating the same rotating turbulent flow, and also that both methods give similar results, at least where you can compare them. And then we went to the PDFs of the Lagrangian velocities, the velocities of the particles in the flow. And what we see here is basically, we have to distinguish between horizontal velocities of the particles in the rotating flow and vertical velocities. When we consider this one from 0 radians to 5 radians per second, the main message here is that the velocity remains basically Gaussian. There are not that much changes. But when we are considering the vertical velocities, we see that when the rotation rates increase strongly, it collapses. So basically, this is a similar observation as in the PIV experiments, where you saw that vertical fluctuations are strongly reduced. That is what we see here as an indication of the two-dimensionalization. Then we go to the acceleration PDFs. So the acceleration of the particles. We are following the tracks, and along the track, we are constantly measuring the acceleration of these particles. And then we see quite interesting results. The left plot is once again in the horizontal plane, and what we see here is that the tails of the acceleration tend to increase. So extreme events will become more and more important when you enhance the background rotation. And that is what you partly can expect. This is also a small scale phenomena, but it is also related with the emergence of larger scale structures in the system. The other one is the vertical acceleration, and there you see just the opposite effect. For all rotation rates, you see that the tails are reduced. I should say here that the black data, that is the non-rotating case, these are benchmarked with literature data for homogeneous isotropic turbulence, and there is a good agreement between this set of non-rotating experiments and the literature data. And what you then see here is that for increasing rotation rate, the tails decrease, so less extreme events, and in the end, any acceleration in the vertical direction is killed, almost killed. Then a quick remark on the velocity autocorrelation, Lagrangian velocity autocorrelations. What we see, the main message here is that the horizontal velocity autocorrelation, so the memory particles will increase with increasing rotation rate. And similar is observed for the vertical velocity autocorrelation. And I make one remark, I did not discuss these Eulerian data, but what is important here is that for these particles, we see that this vertical velocity autocorrelations are much more pronounced here for the Lagrangian case compared to the Eulerian case. And the reason is that in the Eulerian case you are sampling a full plane, while in the Lagrangian case particles may stay more preferred near one of the large scale structures in the system. And you have to take that into account. And the last part is about the acceleration autocorrelations. For the non-rotating case, we get here almost the results from the literature. One remark, all curves, all data points for the Cartesian components should show this behavior. Found in the literature for the non-rotating case, we have some deviation for the vertical one, but realize most of the data from the literature are for the 3D periodic box. And here we have to deal with boundaries. We can then see the effect of rotation on these autocorrelations. And when we have the Cartesian accelerations, then yeah, we see some effects, but it is a bit difficult to understand what is going on here. So what we did then is to go to a different decomposition. Not the Cartesian components, but we decomposed the acceleration along the particle trajectory in a longitudinal part and a transversal part. And the transversal part was split up in a horizontal one and in a vertical one. And if you do that, you immediately realize that actually only the acceleration component, the transversal one in the horizontal plane, is parallel to the Coriolis force. So there you should see, observe, when you're following the particles, the basic effect of the background rotation. But that is a direct effect, but the question is also, do you also see effects on the two other components that are indirect effects? And yes, you see them. What we did here is for the first showing this correlation for the non-rotating case, basically the same as before, except the detail I will come on if there is a question about this, but this is the main point. This is the acceleration, transversal, horizontal. Here you see a huge effect of Coriolis, but the two other components, you still see an effect of the background rotation. The minimum is shifted towards longer times, and the depth of it is being decreased a bit. And this is my last slide, giving a summary of the main results with the Lagrangian statistics and rotating turbulence. Now, next steps we are planning to make is to, in our lab, we are mostly working on small scale effects of. We are focusing on the small scale turbulent effects with the role of stratification, the role of rotation. But we are collaborating also with other teams, for example, at Delft University with civil engineering, where we try to connect what we are doing on the small scales with experiments, what the other party is doing in relation with large scale modeling of, for example, the flow in the North Sea. And then to understand what are the consequences of stratification of particle transport in these realistic situations. And in that way, trying to couple our modeling and experiments with the models our colleagues are trying to implement. Thank you very much.
I know it's getting late, but you were very honest about how you work with about 128 cube, 256 cube that you have to run for a long time. And you also mentioned how in a purely stratified case, the vertical gradients play a subtle role in affecting the dispersion. I'm just curious, I know that, you know, Jim Riley has done some work in Steve de Bruijnkamp's, when you're the product of some local Reynolds number times true number square is big enough, the shearing between the pancakes starts to produce the secondary turbulence.
Yes, I know.
Can you speculate what would happen there, or with the picture?
We didn't do anything there, simply because there, what I explained about what is the state of the art in homogeneous isotropic turbulence is high resolution, high Taylor-based Reynolds number, so that you can explore the Lagrangian statistics, because you only need one or two additional overtimes. This is different in the stratified case. We need at least 100 to get the full picture. And then we run into trouble with this kind of approach. This is what we actually would like to do.
Yeah.
But maybe we need to be a bit patient.
And it's not easy. It's based on what you have, you can't speculate what you might
expect. No, we are in a, some of them, there is a paper by, I think, the French group who, presented the kind of regime diagram. Some of the simulations are just on the right side.
Okay, I know
that one, and other ones are outside.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So there are all these terms for the particle equation of motion. Have you looked at whether, and you did a really nice way of showing the significance of them, have you looked at approximating that equation as an asymptotic expansion in the Stokes number? So you just get a particle velocity as a function of the fluid velocity.
No, we have not looked at it, not in that way.
Along the same lines, you place great emphasis on including the Bassett term, and you use the form that's found in the Maxi Riley paper, which
yes.
is really discussing the motion of a single particle.
Yeah.
Now, the physics of the Bassett term is that a particle interacts with the vorticity that it has shed during its past history. And I'm wondering whether what you should really be doing is looking at, since you have many different particles involved, shouldn't you be looking at the interaction of particles with the overall vorticity field shared by all of the other particles?
Yes, when you have the Bassett force in itself, then actually it is the interaction of the particle, indeed with the vorticity, but basically the vorticity generated in its own boundary layer, and it are not the vortices shed by the particle. That is, I think, an important distinction, and for that reason, I think the interaction with other particles are not that relevant here. But I agree, there are a few more ways to formulate the memory kernel in these in the Bassett force. That take into account some more effects. That is indeed an option also to consider. We have not done that. We think that the approach we are using for computing the Bassett force can equally well be used for this kind of different kernels.
Well, I essentially have a very similar question. Is it the Bassett term? I mean, we've just heard what it is. And it's essentially the vorticity diffusing out from
yes.
the particle. And since this is long range, like 1 over R, it makes a big effect, but it gives a strong delay. But now, I mean, you're simulating the fluid in the surrounding, and it's strongly turbulent. So essentially, if you take this term along, you make the implicit assumption that you can superimpose the linear propagation of the vorticity from the particle with the turbulent flow that's going on all around. And that's not clear to me how whether this is a good or a poor assumption. It's entirely unclear to me. Can you make such a superposition principle for turbulent flows? Is this something that in general has been investigated? Or
yes, it has been done. You can add particles with finite volumes in turbulent flows. That has been done recently. And what you see there is that that a kind of Maxi Riley approach is valid even a bit outside the regime proposed by Maxi Riley. So,
I
showed some results with
deep.
Basically, you need to have particles that are substantially smaller than the Kolmogorov, in case of terms than the Kolmogorov scale, so that you really separate these effects you are mentioning.
Okay, then you have a spatial
chain
separation between the vortex, the vorticity diffusion,
yes.
which takes place
and
on
the surround,
relatively short scale, and far out you have the. But this is. Okay.
But there are now simulations indicating that up to the size of the particle a few times the Kolmogorov scale, it seems to work fine.
It
makes you
fine.
So you can go a bit up, but not too far.
Okay, you could imagine that you have to truncate this term with an exponential cutoff at a time corresponding to the diffusion time.
Yeah, yeah, but its contribution
for the Kolmogorov length to diffuse
its contribution is then already, I think, rather limited.
And it becomes less important, so that may explain why people drop it.
Maybe I can add something to that. So the another variation to this specificity term comes from the fact that the velocity fields are changing. So I mean,
exactly.
This assumes that the particle is moving and that the asymptotic speed is sort of constant.
Yeah.
If you sort of bring in the time dependence, this 1 over distance is cut off with an exponential.
That's what I meant. Okay.
And therefore, I think that sort of, I mean, locally for the particle, the history term is important, and it's as singular as it is.
Yes.
But then the longer term effects will cancel out both through the changes in the velocity field.
That's what I think. So you get a cutoff on the order of the time scale it needs to diffuse, it puts diffuse at the 1-1 order of scale or something like that.
That's not the part that makes the numerics complicated.
No, I don't think so.
No, in this work, yeah.
Tail you can sort of take various ways. The singularity is at t equals 0.
Yes.
How accurate is the Stokes term when you've got a stratified environment? Because presumably the basic drag flow field will become more two-dimensional, and there'll be, you know, internal wave drag. So then that's, you know, that's
yes, but it's not only for a stratified case, the particle has a certain size, so what about some non-linear effects? We have tested this kind of things, and also for the stratified case, we assume it is fine. I think it is still fine, but you have to be very careful, because when it when the local stratification gets starts to interfere with or gets a similar size as your particle, you're running into trouble. But we have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Any more questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And, let me